This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Chapter this week. Let me tell you the story. David has to decide where to live. Now that's not such an easy question for some people. Some people seem to find that a very simple question, but for some people it's not so simple, including for David. And David therefore turns to the room between him once again. He asks for God's advice on where he should go to live, what city he should go to live in. God tells him to go to Hebron, which he does. He takes his wives, his family, his office bearers, and he goes and establishes his presence in the town of Hebron. He's told that the people of Yavesh Gilad had been particularly caring about Shaul. You remember Shaul was brutally murdered, mortally wounded, and finally virtually committed suicide. His son Yonathan was killed, and the people of Yavesh Gilad went out of their way amidst great danger to recover the body of Shaul and to bury it with dignity back in their territory. And David, unlike the characteristic new king who might resent any honor that had been shown by his people to the previous regime, David on the contrary goes to the people of Yavesh Gilad, congratulates them for the dignity they displayed towards Shaul, thanks them for it, prays that God should bless them, and assures them that he will do kindness with them too. Now the chief characters of the rest of the story of today's chapter, of chapter 2, are a son of Shaul, one surviving son of Shaul, whose name is Ishbosheth, Shaul's general, whose name is Avner, David's general, whose name is Yoav. And Yoav's brothers, one of whom plays a central part in the chapter, whose name is Asael. Those are the key characters in the events of this chapter, and strange events they are, and rather topical. So what happens is, David is now established in Hebron, and becomes the king of Yehuda, the tribe of Yehuda, which is his own home tribe. He is descended from Yehuda. Avner, the officer of Shaul, brings Ishbosheth, Shaul's son, and parades him through the country, one province at a time, and gains acceptance of Ishbosheth to be the successor to Shaul. So we now have two kings. We have David, who is the king in Yehuda, and Ishbosheth, who is the king in the rest of Israel. And this arrangement lasts for about 7.5 years. But during this time, there's a fairly friendly relationship, nothing terrible has happened, and some of the men, the army of Avner, and some of the army of Yav, that's the army of Shaul and the army of David, some young boys, were sitting on two sides of the river, taking it easy. It wasn't a war, it wasn't a battle, and Avner semi-jokingly says to Yav, let's try out their strength, let them play with each other. Let them wrestle with each other. Let's see whose side is stronger. And they start to play, and the play moves into a wrestling mode, and the wrestling mode moves into a violent mode, and the violent mode moves into a murder mode, and they start killing each other. Yoav gets very angry, and particularly Asael gets very angry, and Asael begins to pursue Avner, holding him responsible for the bloodbath. Asael is pursuing Avner, running after him and gaining ground on him. Asael is a very fast runner and is narrowing the gap. Avner running as fast as he can. He can see in Asael's eyes the burning fury, and Avner realizes only too well that if Asael catches up with him, Avner is going to be killed. And he stops and he appeals to Asael and he says, hold back, stop, this is ridiculous. pretend you're chasing somebody else. Don't worry about the lack of dignity that's going to look odd if you suddenly stop chasing after me. Just run down one of the side streets and catch somebody else. Asaya refuses. He pursues Avner. And finally, Avner, in self-defense, stops, takes his spear, and hits Asaya with the butt of his spear, intending not to kill him, but at least to stop him. But Asaya must have been running at such a pace that even the butt of Avner's spear pierces the body of Asaya, comes out the other end, and Asaya drops down dead. Meanwhile, the rest of David's army are running and trying to catch up, and they come up to Asaya and they find him lying dead in the territory there. And now they all begin to pursue Avner, led by Yoav. Avner finally appeals to Yoav and says, this is going to end in some terrible tragedy. Stop the fighting. Let's sort this out some other way. And Yoav reluctantly stops and says, Avner, you really started. One word from you could have prevented it all in the first place. But he pulls back, and some 17 men of David's have been killed in the process, and some 360 or 365 men of Shaul's army have been killed in the process. So it's been a terrible tragedy for no real reason. But it starts off quite a bitter interaction between these two kingdoms. And later on in the history of Israel, of course, the kingdom of the 10 tribes of Israel and Yehuda and Binyamin, on the other hand, exist. There are two kingdoms. But that's much later on. During these 7 years, it's only Yehuda that accepts David as the king, and the rest of Israel, including Binyamin, accepts Ishbosheth as the king. And I say it's topical because if we try and track the origins of this tragedy, it was 360 men of David's died. If we try and track the origins, it gets tracked to this game they were playing. And I mentioned that it's been topical because there has for so long been an attempt to disassociate the games children play with the violence that exists in the streets. And this week isn't the first time, last week, that attempts have been made to make the connection, and that there's been a much more open acceptance of the connection. The last time it happened, which wasn't so long ago, reference was made to this already, that the president in an address the last time it happened appealed to the manufacturers of and designers of video games to try and be a little less violent. If we really believed, and it's quite peculiar when you think of it, how we go after the tobacco companies. All the tobacco companies is they produce a product which people are free to use or not to use. But the video game makers are destroying the fabrics of the society. And it's not just the video game makers. It goes far further than that, as I've been trying to think on it. And sure, some might argue that this is just an odd case and these are crackpots. But you need to know that you can judge a society by the quality of its crackpots. Because societies, different societies produce different kinds of crackpots. There's some societies that produce, do you say crackpots in America? I don't know. But you know what I mean. There's some societies whose crackpots do crazy things. What do? They do cartwheels in the street. They sing. They talk to themselves. Remember the days when people used to say, if you talk to yourself, the time you're mad. Now they say, if you murder a whole lot of children, you're mad. Different societies produce different symptoms of madness. This society allows madness to express itself any way it wants to. If you're mad, you can do anything and get away with it. We see that all the time. We accept, we tolerate. The courtroom will let a madman off no matter what he did. So societies deserve the madman they get. And our society is producing madmen in the manifestation of murderers. And then we say, but he's just a madman. Sure, he's just a man. But if you want to really understand society, look at the great people and look at the madmen. And then you've got the spectrum, then you know where the society is. And if you look at that spectrum in our society, and you look at the quality of the great people, not the greatness of what they produce. A lot of the great things that are produced by our society are not produced by great people. They're produced by clever people. They're produced by hard-working people. They're produced by brilliant people. But not great people. So if you understand that distinction, and I ask you then to stop for a moment and count in your hand the number of great people you know in the United States today. Great human beings. And they should start rolling off. You should, a country this size, with the media that we have, they should be in the headlines every day. You should be able to roll off their names. You should run out of fingers. You should be on your toes in seconds, trying to find place to put them all. I can't think. Great people? Great people. Clever people, famous people, celebrities, great people? Gee, you've got to think. How many are we? 450 million? 450 million? 470. Sorry, 270. 270. Sorry. That explains why there are no great people. I was wondering, 470 million, only 270 million people. 270 million people with the finest economy and best educational system in the world. And you can't think of the great people. And we say we're a healthy society. And then we look at our Meshugoyim. Well, where are the Meshugoyim? Go and look at a Meshugoyim in Yerushalayim. An old, the Turekarit of Meshugoyim. We'll find walking around Meir Shorim. What are you doing? He's babbling to him. Not hurting anybody. Come and look at a Meshugoyim here. Look what they're doing. What does that tell us about the spectrum? Where are we? Do we have a spectrum? Or are we totally focused and concentrated on the dregs of society? Clever dregs, brilliant dregs, technologically superior dregs. But where is the greatness? We're not producing greatness, and we're producing a disturbing degree of violence, of decadence, of emptiness, of vacuum, of degeneracy. And we think we're okay. Not to any intelligent person, we're not. We're in severe crisis. It's not just the video games. If you think of the old movies, when somebody used to die in the old movies, what were people doing? The tissues were out. People were crying when somebody used to die. A death, whether it was by a disease or somebody was killed, or it was a death, it was people cried. When people are killed in the movies now, it's true, it's usually the baddie that's killed. Not always, but usually. But it becomes a celebration. People cheer. That violence, even if it's the baddie that's killed, it doesn't matter. What it does is, it turns death into a celebration. It turns the death of bad people into a celebration. Let's even give them the benefit of the doubt and say they've turned the death of bad people into a celebration. That makes it very easy to label somebody bad and then celebrate his demise. Death should never be a celebration, not of good people, not of bad people. Death is nothing to cheer. But you go into the movie houses and you see the kids cheering when somebody's killed, when somebody's wiped out. And there's a detachment. There's not only identification, you know, to create a movie where you develop an emotional attachment with a character in 1 hour or 1.5 hours, that requires artistry. And artistry doesn't always sell so well. So we land up producing movies that are not of artistic great quality, and therefore do not create within the individual any kind of empathy with the character. So when the character is killed, you feel nothing. And children and adults begin to become immune to the degree to which death and killing is shocking. Does that mean that a normal healthy adult will go out and shoot people? No, he won't. Just as the sex on movies is not an excuse for crazy sexual behavior, so violence on movies is not an excuse for an individual to behave violently. But we will produce an interesting breed of crazy people. A society like this will produce crazy people that kill, until we start to do something about it. And here we have in our chapter of Tanakh this very week, kids start off as a game. But a game where people are the target sows the seeds of violence. In a healthy game, the ball is a target. The goalpost is a target. The net is a target. Not people. A society that allows people to be the target of play is a society that is giving permission for violence, that is licensing violence. And whether it's an individual being targeted, a human being being targeted in violent play or in verbally violent play, that's also not acceptable. The kind of radio talk that we hear, the complete assassination of character, and even when it's for good reason, people somehow think that if the guy you're attacking is bad, it's okay. It's not okay. Abusive radio is not okay, because that leaves everybody to decide who the bad guy is. Doesn't mean that because the talk show host is a conservative that that makes his abuse kosher. It doesn't. There shouldn't be any abusiveness allowed. But then our crazy society says we're limiting people's freedom of speech. And if we stop the murdering, are we limiting their freedom of action? The fact that we're going to have to start controlling people's freedom because we are showing ourselves as incapable of being worthy of the freedom we've been granted as a society. And that sooner or later this society is going to need to have a look at itself and say, we'd better fix something, either the way we raise and educate our people or the way we govern our people. But we can't offer people no moral education and offer them no governance either. You're not trained in moral thought, and nor are you governed by moral laws. That there is freedom and no education, then we're back to the jungle. Then we'll see with some interesting Darwinian theory when we finally produce an ape, as we devolve back towards the jungle. And there's an interesting comment on Erlberg. Some of the talk show comments, some has been very interesting and meaningful, and some has been absurd. But one was how religion is not permitted to be taught in the classroom. But I found out in addressing a group of teachers this last week that nothing can be taught in the classroom. Nothing. You can simply convey information, provided you're absolutely sure that you have a source somewhere for your information. You may not give opinions. You cannot teach courtesy. You cannot teach dignity. You cannot teach respect, because you will be sued, the teachers told me. So there's absolutely no attempt to teach not only religion, but even basic derech eretz of the simplest, lowest order. We're not producing, but we're not teaching in the classroom anymore. And religion? I would rather the kids were learning Christianity in the classes, Jewish kids, than that they were learning nothing. Because if they're learning a religion, any religion, they'll be learning some humanity. There will be many theology that we disagree with, so we'll have to teach them the right theology. But to expose children to an upbringing of vacuous moral teaching. And then the teacher said to me, but surely this should be coming from the families, from the homes. Surely we shouldn't have to teach this. And I said to them, do you mean to say that you haven't yet latched on that you're teaching in orphanages? That this is a society of street urchins? These kids don't have homes. What is a home? A house? A building? What do they have when they go home? A television set. That's all they have. Their parents aren't at home. And when their parents come home, their parents are tired and drained and have their own things to worry about. Where's the home? Look at our society. No home, no school. And religion is unconstitutional to first down anybody's throat. So those who want religion can get religion, but those who want religion are not the people who need it. So there's no way to communicate moral value to people who don't want it communicated to them. So we say, well, you're free to decide. If you want to learn morality, go to church and somebody will teach you, but not in the school and not in the home, because the home has ceased to exist and the schools aren't allowed to do it. But then when kids are killed, we have prayer sessions. All of a sudden we turn to God. And somebody wrote into this radio show and said, do we only use religion to recover from death, but we're not allowed to use it to prevent death? Isn't that a powerful question and an indictment on our society? Avner allows the young boys to play with each other, where the kids become the targets. And that should never be allowed, not in a school playroom, not in a school classroom, and not in the entertainment areas, in the videos or films or games that kids are given. I was told, I didn't hear it, but I was told that on Michael Medved's show, he was interviewing a person, some of you might have heard it, who was responsible for training soldiers to kill. And he was talking apparently about how difficult it is to train a person to kill, a person who's brought up in a normal background. Because it's really very hard. And I remember in South Africa when things were very bad and people were buying guns, including ourselves, and we went for training sessions and the police were giving training sessions. And the one thing that they tried to impress on us is the chances are we won't be able to shoot. We can train you as much as we want to, but when a human being is standing in front of you, no matter how threatening that human being is, the chances are that your finger will freeze on the trigger. And if that happens, you'll be killed first. So best you don't even use your gun. Best don't even have one. Because you don't know how hard it is to actually shoot a human being. And this person was saying that the way they train people is on video games. They train people, and he named the same video games that these kids were playing. That's what we use to get people over the inhibition of killing other human beings. So the army has already realized the power of simulation to overcome the inhibition of morality. And we know the power of simulation. Speak to a pilot of these major airliners, and they'll tell you that the first time they take passengers on many airlines is the first time they're flying a plane. Their entire training is on simulators. The power of electronic simulation to be able to help a person overcome fears is enormous. So to help a person overcome the fear of wiping out the enemy, they help. And these kids are spending hours and hours doing that, but we won't teach them morality. We're not allowed to teach them to respect their teachers. We're not allowed to teach them to respect one another. We're not allowed to teach them not to talk Lashon Hara. We're not allowed to teach them not to be violent. We can't even teach them to respect their parents, because that's impinging on their constitutional rights. But to allow them to spend hours upon hours upon hours, days upon days upon days, playing with the machine that the army uses to teach people to kill, that's not impinging on their constitutional rights. That's called freedom in this crazy society. Isn't there something wrong? People accept it and they go on. I'm not saying this crazy society. I'm not talking about the United States of America. The whole of Western society is moving in that direction. We're playing a pretty leading role in leading society. But it's not just here. It's particularly pronounced here. But we need to track it back in the case of our chapter even be earlier than that. What made Avner put Ishbosheth into the throne when he knew that David was standing by and everything was organized? That's really where it started. Why did he create a second kingdom? He based it on a verse in Bereshis. After God changed Yaakov's name to Yisrael in chapter 35, Vayomer lo Elokim, Hashem said to Yaakov, Ani kel Shaddai, I am the Lord your God, Perei urevei, be fruitful and multiply, Goy ukahal goyim yiyemimeko, a nation and a community of nations will emerge from you. And then the critical words, Umelochim mechalotzecho yetzeu, and kings will come from your energy. And Rashi says, all his children were born already, except for one, Binyamin. The youngest son of Yaakov was not yet born. And God says in the future tense that you will progenate a kings, Malachim, kings. And Rashi says, Malachim, who are the kings? Shaul the Ishbosheth. There were only two kings of Israel that are descended from Binyamin, Shaul and Ishbosheth. And Rashi says, "Ufosuk zeh derashoy Avner." And Avner used this verse, "Kishehimich Ishboshet," when he made Ishboshet the king. So Avner said to himself, Yaakov was promised kings in the plural from Binyamin. So far there's only been one, that's Shaul. Shaul has only one son. So clearly it is God's intention that before David becomes king, another descendant of Binyamin has to be the king. And so using this as his authority, he persuades the entire nation, with the exception of Yehuda, to accept Ishbosheth as the king. A good source. Asks Tosfos, in that case, this is in Sanhedrin on Daf Chaf, what did he do wrong? And what happened to Shmuel? Why didn't Shmuel know this when Shmuel anointed him king? And Tosfos answers with a principle that is so fundamental to our understanding of the Torah. Mikol makom hayo yochol yiskayim b'mokom acher v'lo hayalo l'shahot malchus beis David shimim shach kvar api novi. If that's performing, then just cut it out here. Our first responsibility is to the people who are at the shul. Later on we can worry about the tapes and things. So Tosfos says, if we have a verse, there's a source. She seems to be right, Avner. But there's a source that where God says, in the future there will be two kings, at least two kings, it's in the plural. What did he do wrong? Answers Tosfot, he should have realized that Shmuel had already anointed David. And it's not for him to worry about where the second king descended from Binyamin will come from. God will take care of that in good time. What we have here is an error based on a conflict between a written source and an oral tradition. The fact is, there's a written source that from Binyamin there will be two kings. The fact is, there's only been one king, and that king has a son. So if you're just using the written source, the decision should clearly be that Ishbosheth is the king, and that's Avner's decision. But there's an oral tradition that's come with Shmuel, and that is that David is the next king. There was a prophet, there was a scholar, and his source is an oral tradition from God, and his source is that David is the king. By following the written tradition instead of the oral tradition, Avner establishes these two forces which begin a bloody battle, the first of which we've learnt about today, but not the last. That's one of the biggest challenges that faces particularly, but not only, the Baal Tshuva community, people who are becoming religious, because their access to Jewish knowledge is primarily through the written word. On the one hand, we're very fortunate that a lot of the written word has become available in English through Art Scrolls and other such publishers. On the other hand, it's quite a pity that it's become so accessible, and that's the one problem. The internet is another, the kind of things that are accessible to wide ranges of people, which means the written word is accessible to people now without the accompaniment of oral tradition, and that's incredibly dangerous, because when you're writing something down, it's in black and white. It's very difficult to write down the colors in between. It's almost impossible to do so. You cannot cover every possibility. You cannot show and demonstrate how to weigh things up and how to utilize the various different mechanisms we have to deal with the gray areas. So almost anything that is written down, by the very nature of written communication, requires rigidity. You cannot write something down and keep it flexible. You cannot write something down and keep it dynamic. Once it's written down, it's rigid. And the process of writing down is rigid. And what you can write about is only something rigid. It's almost impossible, unless you write poetically, it's almost impossible to write about something fluid, to describe something fluid. You would need enormous artistic talent to be able to do that.
And that's why the oral law was forbidden to be written down until the time of the Mishnah. But we were forbidden to write down the oral law. God specifically didn't want the oral law to be written, because once it's written it ceases to be oral, and once it's no longer oral it is no longer flexible and no longer dynamic. And the compromise was writing it down in a way that cannot be understood without oral accompaniment. Take a piece of Gemara and try and understand it without being taught. Very difficult, almost impossible. Certainly to get the true meaning of it. And that guaranteed the continuation of an oral tradition around a written text. So the people would study the written text together, but would explore it orally. They would explore it intellectually. They would move, they would be questioning, there would be dialogue. It wouldn't just be a take it or leave it situation, which is the nature of the written word. There's no dialogue in the written word. You read the book, you can't ask any questions. That's what it says. You either accept it or you don't. But when you're having a shiur, when you're discussing the written work in an oral context, there is the opportunity for questioning, for understanding, for probing, for challenging, and in that develops the color that is so important to the process of learning. But since the Second World War, and particularly with the rise of the Baal Teshuva movement, access to the oral tradition has become very difficult. And that has introduced a rigidity and a dogmatism into our understanding and practicing of the Torah, which was very foreign to us before. And here we see an example of the dangers of choosing the written over the oral. I've explained in some of the halacha shiurim that I've given that our source for halacha, our source for Jewish law, if you want to know what are you supposed to do in a given situation, the source is not the Shulchan Aruch. The source is your grandfather, or should be. Your father, your grandfather, your rabbi's grandfather and great grandfather, that should be the source. Because that's how you access an oral tradition. What would my teacher have done in this situation? What did my father or grandfather used to do in this situation? That's the true source. As the Torah itself says, Sha'al avicha v'yagedecha, zekhebecha v'yomulach. Ask your father and he will tell you. When you have a doubt, ask your elders and they will explain to you. Rav Meir Soloveitchik asked when he discussed this with me, why doesn't it just say ask your elders? Elders mean scholars. If you have a problem, ask the specialists. Why your father? Who says your father's an authority? What is the authority of your father? Your father can tell you about the family Maisalach. But Sha'al avicha, if you have a problem in Jewish thinking and Jewish approach, why your father? He explains, because some things are sourced from tradition, not from scholarship. The scholarship is the check. We keep on checking our tradition against the scholarship. The source is the tradition. The scholarship is the check. Is it still authentic? Are we on track? The Shulchan Aruch is there to explain the linkage between the traditions of today and the sources of yesteryear, but not as a source in itself from which we draw the knowledge. The knowledge should be drawn from tradition. Avner chooses the written law as his source of knowledge, as his source of information, and makes a decision, ignoring the fact that there's an oral tradition that overrides the written one. Far more important. You know the lovely story when the convert comes to Hillel and says to him, teach me the whole Torah. Not the one who says, while I'm standing on one limb, teach me the whole Torah. But I only want the written Torah. Don't teach me what the rabbi said, because I don't buy that stuff what the rabbi said. I want to know what God said. That's all. And he said to him, fine, the first thing you know today is Aleph, the second letter is Beis, the third one is Gimel, teaches it to the convert, he learns the alphabet, comes back the next day. He says, right, can you review your lesson from yesterday? He says, sure, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dal. He says, really, you converts, can you never get it right? Didn't I tell you, the first letter was Taf, second letter is Shin, the third letter is Resh. Congress says, oh, 1 second. Yesterday, I'm sure you told me Aleph was the first letter and Taf was the last letter. Today, you're telling me Taf was the first, last letter and Shin is the same. Taf is the first and Aleph is the last. And he says, so you're going to have to believe me. How else are you going to access God's word if you aren't going to trust me? You cannot learn tradition without that trust. You cannot say, I want to know what God said, but not what the rabbi said. Who are you going to believe as to what God said? How are you going to know what God said? Where does it say what you put inside your tefillin? All it says in the Torah is one little verse. You shall write them on your arms and for frontlets between your eyes. That's what it says. How do you know what a tefillin is supposed to look like? How to make a tefillin? When to wear the tefillin? What goes inside the tefillin? How do you know that? You build a sukkah. How do you know how to build a sukkah? All it says, build booths for yourselves. It says, what builds, how builds, when builds, nothing. We're not told those things. These are all the oral laws that have been passed down by tradition. So the Torah without the tradition, without the Masoreth, is completely absurd and meaningless, and inflexible and dogmatic. It is the rabbinic law that comes down orally from Sinai. So not rabbinic law that is made up, it is rabbinic law that comes down from Sinai, but with that oral tradition comes the power of the rabbis to adapt and to apply. So that it doesn't become stagnant, so that it doesn't become clinic and fragile, that it remains dynamic and it remains able to be used in every generation. And we cannot separate the one from the other, but the source of knowledge and the source of decision is the tradition, not the written law. Avner goes for the written law. And as a result of that, he establishes Binyamin, he establishes Ishbosheth as king in Israel. We'll discuss next week some of the differences between the two kings, between the two traditions. We touched on it in the Wednesday morning late issue, which this week will be on Friday morning. The powers that each of the mothers invested in their children. That Leah was the mother of Yehuda, and Rochel was the mother of Binyamin. And we discussed in the recent Lady Shir how each of those two mothers wanted to ensure that they had a significant input into the founding generation of the Jewish people. Because it was their children that were going to be the 12 tribes of Israel, each one with its own dominant characteristic that would then shape the destiny of the Jewish people. And Leah had certain qualities, and Rachel had certain qualities. And Leah knew that the nation needed her qualities, and Rachel knew that the nation needed her qualities. And what was unique about those qualities? Medrash says the following in Parshas Vayetze, Parsha Ayin Aleph. Leo tafso pelach hodoyo, the ondu hemenu baale hodoyo. Leo grasped for herself the territory of admission, of apology. And her children, and out of her came sons who were masters of apology. Rachel tafso pelach shtika. Rachel grasped for herself the territory of silence. And her children became masters of mystery, masters of silence, masters of understatement. Two different forces in the Jewish people. A force of outward communication, the most outward, fearless communication that there is the communication of an apology. There's hardly anything verbal that requires so much courage as the ability to say, I am responsible, I'm accountable, I'm sorry, and I will repair it. In many leadership scandals, the Nixon one and this country and every country has had their own ones, the problem has inevitably been not the act that occurred, but the failure of the leader early enough to say, it happened. It happened on my watch, I'm responsible, and this is what I'm going to be doing about it. In all those cases, it would have ended there. But it didn't, because that's one of the hardest things to do. And it's that which requires the most courage. So in Leah was the outward courage of admission, of apology. That's what she knew was there, and that was something that the kings needed. Yehuda, the father of the kings, was the master, he was the founder of that concept, of that idea. And Leah and Rachel, on the other hand, was able to develop in her children an understatement, a modesty, a certain being withdrawn from a situation and controlling it from the distance. And the comparison of how they handle sin is quite amazing. Let me just briefly share with you a piece of the Ikrim, a philosophic work by Yosef Albo, very beautifully worked out. And in the fourth section in Perek Chavrov, he makes a comparison between what happens when Shaul was caught sinning. Shaul is descended from Binyamin, a descendant of Leah, and when David is caught sinning, as we learn later on. Descendant of Rachel. And David, descended from Leah, will be caught sinning a little bit later on in the story. What did Shaul do when Shmuel confronted him? First thing he did was, I didn't do anything wrong. Second time, I did wrong, but it was because the people were putting me under pressure and all sorts of side reasons. And the third one is, come with me, Shmuel, honor me in front of the people to show that I'm okay. Says the Ikrim, denial. That's the first mistake. But Shmuel points out to Shaul, as we learned, that worse than the action, and worse was the denial than the denial, was the excuse. Because to say I did it, but it wasn't my fault, that's the worst kind of apology that there is altogether. Because that's trying to get the benefit of the apology without taking responsibility for it. And Shaul couldn't bring himself to say, I did it and it was my fault, I take responsibility. And even when he finally seeks complete atonement, it's to gain acceptance by the people, it's not within himself. And the Ikrim says that's why Shaul lost the kingdom. He didn't lose the kingdom for failing to wipe out Amalek. That could be rectified. He lost the kingdom for failing to take responsibility for not wiping out Amalek. You cannot have a king who will not take responsibility. David, on the other hand, when he's caught out, says, Chachasi odiacho, I'm willing to announce to you my sin. And he says, Ode olai pishi, I will acknowledge my sins. And in Psalms, over and over again, when David deals with his own sin, he deals with it openly. He says, I did it, I take responsibility for doing it. And that's why he remains king. But what's important, as we discussed in the later shiur, is to understand that both of these kings were needed. Because Amalek has to be wiped out before David's kingdom can truly be established. Before the Mashiach can come, Amalek has to be wiped out. Who is Amalek and what is Amalek? You remember Amalek attacked us. How did he attack us coming out of Egypt? From behind, the old people and the sick people. He didn't confront us head on as a courageous warrior. He attacked us with a kind of diplomacy. He attacked our weak points. He didn't confront us. And he's descended from Esau. What was Esau's expertise? Deceitfulness. Illusion, persuading people that things were not what they appeared to be. There is a force that needs to wipe out the effects of Amalek, and there is a force that needs to wipe out our other enemies. The force of Rachel has to be used to wipe out Amalek. Amalek has to be wiped out with subtlety. Amalek has to be wiped out with destroying the effects of Amalekite thinking, not just destroying Amalekites. Zecher Amalek, we've got to wipe out the impact of Amalek. And the impact of Amalek is the use of deception to conquer. Then when that's done, we can use our armies to wipe out any other enemies that we have that need to be wiped out. Shaul was descended from Rachel, and his job was to deal with Amalek. He failed. David was descended from Leah, and his job was to deal with the rest of the enemies of the Jewish people. Avner believed that until Amalek is wiped out, we need a king descended from Benjamin. And he used that verse as his source. The truth was that we'd lost that opportunity to wipe out Amalek. We weren't going to get another one so soon. And meanwhile, the time had come to establish the kingdom of David. So David sits in Hebron, waiting for the time, doing nothing aggressive, making no effort to conquer the rest of Israel, sits there as king of Yehuda for 7.5 years, waiting for the time to come, waiting for his time to come. Next week we'll tie up some loose ends with respect to this episode and move into the further development of the conflict between the followers of Shaul, Ishbosheth and Avner, and the followers of David and Yoav. Well, thank you very much, and I think that our program has an announcement to make.
I'd just like your attention for a moment. First of all, how many people